ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Well, we've turned north. We're heading away from the coast now towards Maralinga, going through Mallee and Saltbush country, just past the dog fence.
Hello, Kirsty Melville here, and welcome to the History Listen and the final episode in our series, The Sands of Uldea.
Mulga country now, and pretty rough corrugations. We can see the Transnational Railway coming up, and it'll be a siding.
So far, we've explored the indigenous history of this crucial water site on the edge of the Nullarbor in remote South Australia. The coming of the Transnational Railway, and with it, anthropologist Daisy Bates, plus the British nuclear tests just north at Maralinga. Now we return to Uldea as it is today. Maralinga Jarraja General Manager Sharon Yendall is guiding us out there.
Yeah, I've just noticed some camel tracks on the road, so can you keep your eyes out for camels?
Here's series producer Mike Ladd.
This episode is called Wankani, a Pitjantjatjara word meaning to return, to restore, to heal.
Maybe a little bit in the very bottom of that one.
Yeah. It almost looks like it's a bit of a puncture.
I'll have to come back down and have a look at these.
So are these like survival tanks, are they? They're just for travellers who get stuck?
About every 50k there's a tank.
This would have been quite close to where Daisy Bates's camp was.
Down that way a bit more, yeah. Along the railway tracks.
Yeah.
After Daisy Bates left Uldea in 1934, the United Aborigines Mission, run first by Annie Locke, then by Harry Green, remained to help with food and clothing. The mission was shut in 1952 and was quickly reclaimed by the Sands of Uldea.
Composed of several cottages and a small fenced-off soak in the middle, the completely deserted settlement was ringed by high, quite bare and loose sandhills, which had crept with the winds to leave only half the normal height of the houses protruding from the Sahara-like dunes. Len Bedell, 1967.
Many of the people from Uldea were sent south to the mission at Yalata.
The Aborigines often expressed their dislike for the dusty grey earth of the Yalata area and said that they wished to return to the clean red sands of the Great Victoria Desert. Palmer, 1982.
Jilpi, they called it. A greyness associated with ageing and death. It wasn't until South Australia's Bannon Labor government passed the Maralinga Jarraja Land Rights Act in 1984 that the people were able to move back into their beloved Red Desert at Oak Valley. Then, in 1991, they got the sacred Uldea soak back.
Aborigines came from everywhere as news of the handover spread throughout the bush. They'd been prohibited from walking on this land for 40 years, so they weren't going to miss today's formal handover ceremony. South Australia's Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, Mike Rann, presented the leaders of the three tribes who lived in the area with the land title papers, giving them exclusive control of Uldea.
Well, this land is theirs. They've got inalienable freehold title. This land was theirs for thousands of years, and it will be theirs for eternity.
my dad, Richard LaBoise, or known as Diggy LaBoise, Archie Barton, Jeffrey Queamer, and then the two uncles, Tommy Queamer, Jack Baker, Mervyn Day, Huey Winless, Barker Bryant, Warren Bryant. These are all the people that all put a lot of effort in to fight for this land back.
Maralinga Jarratja Council Chairperson, Jeremy LaBoise.
I was a young fella at the first handback.
Right.
So I got to see that one. I've seen all the year giving back.
It must have been a very emotional day, very powerful day.
I think it's a powerful day, an emotional day for everyone, especially the older ones. You know, as soon as they, when they first returned back to country, it was really emotional for them, you know, they cry. And it's not a sad, it's a happy cry.
Jeremy has driven down from Oak Valley to meet us at the original handback campsite.
But they always put camps where there's she-oaks.
Yeah. Bit of shade.
Shade, and I think they like to sit down and listen to them, to the trees talk, and the wind blows through it.
The sound I remember most about this place, it's it's amazingly haunting and gentle sound, and it kind of, it's the kind of music of this place.
It's a sound that keeps you company, especially if you're lost in the desert. Keeps you cool. Beautiful sound. And the old people always like camping under these trees.
Yeah.
No matter where they go, if they, you know, if they find this she oak, well, that's where they go. They go and camp under it.
Yeah.
We head off together to Uldia Railway Siding on the transnational line on the edge of the Nullarbor.
This is the Nullarbor. That's the Uldia range that follows, and that goes for miles. That goes other side of Oak Valley, and then it goes, comes from way down south. That's what they used to do, the Aboriginal people, just get up on those high points and then just look ahead, and then okay, that's where I'm walking, going to the next one. So when they both used to come into Uldia, they used to put, send up smoke signals if they're not from this area, just to say, yeah, we're entering in. They had smoke signals that will identify, yes, I'm travelling with a wife and children, or I'm travelling on my own. So I would love to learn it, but unfortunately them old people gone with that knowledge, they took it with them.
So there were a lot of anonga living in this area, a lot. A lot of the anonga relied on the railway line, selling their artifacts and collecting pennies and stuff like that from them. So there, this is a very special place for our normal people. A lot of memories. A lot of good memories and a lot of bad memories. This is where a lot of the off-caste children were taken away from their mothers and fathers. And they were sent to places like Cunniba, Kundalee over in Western Australia, Port Augusta and Riverland, Girard. A lot of those people didn't get to come back to this place. A lot of them made home over there. A lot of them died over there. And then that's some of their grandchildren coming back and trying to find family members or trying to link the chain up again, find out where everyone's coming from. And then a lot of the history is a lot of the people come back, actually basically come from Ordia or have some sort of a tie to this place. Oh, yes, the train.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, great. In the 1980s, most of the outback stations on the Transnational Railway were closed. Automation, concrete sleepers replacing the old Jarrah planks, and welds that joined the rails into a continuous band of steel across the continent meant there was no need for fettlers or station masters. There are no buildings left at Ordia Siding today. The last person I know who actually lived here was Yunkinjarra poet Ali Cobby Eckerman.
You know, when I first went to Ordia, I was 17 and I was running away from everything and I was really mixed up. So I'd been expelled from Clare High School at the end of year 11 for standing up against racism. And other friends of mine were moving up. They had work along the railway line. And I sort of jumped on the train. We went up on an old goods train that carried a few carriages at the end. Just ran away. I didn't even know if I had a suitcase. I just went. We lived in one of the fettlers' houses. I think it was the second one from the left. There were six houses. And then the bush. The desert has a certain sacredness. And I think it's the space. How the desert arranges itself that always speaks to my soul. And in the 2 years that I was there as a teenager, it was the shocking time of when domestic violence came into my life. And despite that, there was something that was keeping me there. During the days when the men were working on the railways in their fettler jobs, I got the opportunity to drive across that patch of the desert, to go out to the old soakage, to walk around. The beautiful memories of me just being out there by myself. Occasionally, mob would come up from Yalata and they'd sit along the railway line on the other side of the railway line from the fettlers' houses and sometimes camp there for a few days. And I would take water bottles over there and sit with them, maybe had some fruit to share because the only shop was the tea and sugar train that came through on Saturdays. I remember the kindness of those old people. Their laughter, their inclusion. And at that point in my life, I didn't know who I was. I was just running away from my adopted family. And I was running away from the feeling that I didn't belong into the society that I'd grown up in. I look back in hindsight now, because it was 15 years after leaving Aldea that I did find my mother. I was successful in finding my mother, and she was still alive. I flew to Canberra to meet her. Her name was Audrey Kinnear. And I remember when I asked her where she was born, and she replied, Aldea, that the world stood still for a few moments. And she was surprised that I had such knowledge of land. And here we were sitting around her kitchen table, meeting for the first time. I've said it before that when my mother told me she was born at Aldea, the first thought that came into my mind and my heart was how much our land loves us, and that somehow I was guided out there in this really remote place in the middle of nowhere, Australia. And the first place that I ran to was my mother's birthplace. I still sit and think about that a lot now that she's gone.
When she was living at Aldea, Ali often spent her days sitting quietly at the old soak to escape her violent partner.
Someone lent me an old Jeep. Probably it was an act of kindness when the black eyes were getting a little bit frequent. And I'd gather up all the dogs. There was about five of them. So we'd go out there. I knew, well, there must be water here. I dug down. I drank water out of the sand like I'd seen on old black and white movies. I probably had to have a few goes. First, it was probably a little bit sandy and a bit muddy, and I was a bit impatient. But if you dig a little bit deeper and let it soak through, the sand will filter itself. And I remember having a bit of a chuckle at myself about being impatient and just waiting. And I remember it was cool.
Yes, the waters have returned to Aldea. It's not true that the railway ruined the soak forever by pumping it dry to fill steam trains. Slowly, over the decades, the ancient water source has healed.
You know, I look back at that landscape and how fragile I was in it. And yet when I met my mum and her sisters and the brother and other family members, how strong they were. I honour the fact that my family's from the desert and I'm a desert woman. I love what the land teaches out there. I love the perspective that that land teaches you about yourself. And the generosity and such an intelligent, simple way of being, I don't see replicated anywhere else. That was my first introduction to the desert as a teenage runaway. And I have always since, even then, held the desert as my home in my heart.
Some old surviving pepper trees with their spicy smell. pink berries. Childhood, hot schoolyard. That's what that smell brings back.
So yes, this is the famous old deer.
Yeah.
But just about every railway siding's always got a pepper tree. You can always tell a siding.
They're survivors, aren't they?
Yes.
In 2016, Jeremy was part of a delegation of Aboriginal people whose lands had been affected by the Maralinga nuclear tests.
Yeah, I was invited to a crew from Yalata, and they were taking a sculpture back over to Japan, to Nagasaki, to put in their peace park. Every other country had a sculpture in their peace park, except Australia. So Yalata thought they all do one. So they made one out of a local timber down in Yalata area, and then they made a dish or a pitty, and they set it on there, which is the symbol of peace in the Anangu eyes. So it carries water, food, digs hole, becomes a bed for a baby as well, shelter for a baby.
Yeah, lovely idea. And you met someone there too, didn't you?
Yeah, I met one of the survivors as well. And, you know, that was pretty emotional, just sitting there and listening to all the survivors that was there on the day when they had a bomb dropped on them. So it's basically just exchanging culture and what we went through, you know. And once you compared it, what we went through and they went through, you know, I think they come out the worst. So, but you know, they survived, they built back on top of it.
Let's talk about Oak Valley today. How's it
going?
Oak Valley's
going great. We've got a ranger program running. We've got a women's program. Art centre. We've also got an art centre. Got our own school. Just need a bit more kids at the moment. The kids that we had, they're all growing up now and all go to school in Adelaide. Only drama we got with Oak Valley is that we don't have enough houses. And sometime our houses that we got there, you know, the kids a bit overcrowded. And the reason why we struggle with getting houses is because every time we get told there's no water.
Do you ever go back to the soak?
No. Because I would like to go back, but because of the vegetation and the sand dunes are moving, getting higher. So basically I know we're just leaving it to rest. You know, there've been too much things that happened at Rudia.
Right. But you're still custodians of that place.
We are still Rudia of that place, custodians. You leave it alone, it'll look after himself. Don't interfere. You know, you don't go and dig up someone's cemetery. It's the same thing. Let it rest. It'll call you back when it wants you to come back. That's how Anangu works. Let it heal itself. And then it'll call you when it wants you.
Thank you.
And that was the final part of The Sands of Aldea. Our readers were Chris Pittman and Mark Saturno. Original music was by Jakub Gałdyszynski, sound engineering by Tom Henry, and production was by me, Mike Ladd. Thanks for your company, and bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.